The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir. Coming up this week, Mr. Cameron goes to Washington. As Obama rolls out the red carpet, can Britain learn anything from America in the week before the budget? And with only weeks remaining until London elects its mayor, can Boris Johnson be beaten? And who's reading political memoirs? Anybody? We'll reveal all with our star-packed lineup this week. Joining me in the studio, the Conservative blogger, publisher and radio presenter Ian Dale, independent London mayoral candidate Siobhan Benita, and on the line from Hackney, our London politics expert Dave Hill. A warm welcome to all of you.
David, we are chuffed to bits that you are here. And I'm looking forward to a great natter. I'm confident that together we're going to keep the relationship between our two great nations absolutely top-notch.
Well, a ride on Air Force One and a trip with the President to a college basketball game. David Cameron's had the sort of welcome from the President that his predecessors could only dream of. Our chief political correspondent Nick Watt followed the Prime Minister to the White House.
The welcome that Barack Obama gave David Cameron on the South Lawn of the White House was pretty much a state visit. Can't be a state visit fully because obviously the Prime Minister is a mere head of government. There was the 19-gun salute, the military on parade, national anthems and all that. But it went much deeper than that. And the reason why it's been such a success is that Barack Obama really gave the most ringing endorsement of the special relationship, the Anglo-American special relationship, the most ringing endorsement of any president, really, in living memory. The point about Barack Obama is he's not a natural Atlanticist. When he became president, he wanted to sort of recast American influence towards Asia and towards the Pacific. And here he was today saying that down the years, the rock-solid Anglo-American special relationship is always there, and it has never been stronger than it is today.
Is that because of Cameron or despite him? Because weren't there reports that Obama had described Cameron as a lightweight?
I'm not sure he described him as a lightweight, but I think he was surprised when he made an innocent point to David Cameron about Europe and got an earful of Euroscepticism and was slightly taken aback by that. But they do personally have a good relationship. There is good chemistry. But what you're finding with Barack Obama is coming to the end of his first term, the sort of the natural pressures always reassert themselves. And the natural pressures are that when it comes to a military alliance, the alliance with the UK is always going to be strongest. And if you said to Barack Obama, what are the five strategic threats to the United States at the moment? One of them would be the future of the European Union and the future of the euro. If the euro tanks, that is seen as a strategic threat. So not a bad thing to be getting on well with the English-speaking leader of the largest European Union country, although obviously UK not in the euro.
So lovely pictures of Cameron. He ate a hot dog. But what else did he gain from being over there?
Well, he's had some pretty substantive conversations with Barack Obama. Of course, a visit like this is going to have a lot of pomp and ceremony. You know, the present safe swap, David Cameron gave the Obamas a special made Dunlop table tennis table. The Obamas have given the Camerons a very, very fancy charcoal and wood burning grill so they can have barbecues at Chequers. So there's a lot of pomp and ceremony, but they've had very serious discussions about Afghanistan, about Syria, about Iran. And of course, David Cameron was accompanied by George Osborne and William Hague. So William Hague has had pretty serious conversations with Hillary Clinton. He was obviously at the UN in New York with her earlier this week. And George Osborne having pretty serious talks with Tim Geithner, who's his US counterpart.
Does Obama gain anything domestically very quickly?
I think that we in the UK can get awfully excited about our significance over here. We are, at the end of the day, a medium-sized European power. Where it may have some impact electorally is that where did Barack Obama take David Cameron on his first night? He took him to Ohio. Ohio is, of course, the key swing state. Probably won't be massively noticed, but it does the president no harm to be seen in a key swing state like that.
Okay, Ian Dale, Nick Watt certainly seem to think that the trip's been a success. Will it have done anything for David Cameron back here?
I suspect very little, actually. I mean, the pictures are good, but I don't think there's a lot of substance to this trip. They've obviously held discussions on Afghanistan, but I don't think much new has come out of that. We know what the timetable for withdrawal from Afghanistan is. Very little seems to have changed on that. I think the main thing that comes out of these trips is that the leaders get to know each other better. They build up a better personal relationship. And a lot of international diplomacy does depend on how two individual leaders get on with each other. Now, it's quite clear that these two get on rather better than Barack Obama seemed to with Gordon Brown. You can't imagine Gordon Brown going to one of those baseball games, can you, particularly?
He must be biting chunks out of his forearm when he sees the sort of reaction, the sort of reception David Cameron got.
It is natural in a way because they're of a similar age. Okay, they have very, very different backgrounds, but there does seem to be that personal chemistry there, a bit like Clinton and Tony Blair or Thatcher and Reagan. And I mean, those two, they actually achieved a lot through the so-called special relationship. I mean, I'm starting to cringe when I hear this word, because the main objective of a British Prime Minister going to the States is to get that phrase uttered by the American president as often as possible. I actually find it rather embarrassing. If you have to say it so often, you just wonder how special it is.
Siobhan, there was a lot of criticism about him going in the Daily Mail on Thursday. Stephen Glover calls it a gruesome love-in and basically says that what's he doing over there, particularly in the days before a budget? Given your experience in Whitehall, would you have needed the Chancellor here?
I think it is a bit strange that the Chancellor's gone, but I think people do like to see those pictures of the two leaders together. Whether it's the right timing or not, I think, is debatable. There are so many issues at home that people are worried about at the moment, so I think they will be focused on those. It's interesting, the special relationship, now they're calling it the essential relationship. What makes me laugh is just, how many people were buried in a thesaurus or a dictionary weeks before this visit to come up with that one word that both countries were happy with.
And you will know about the sort of preparation that goes behind a trip
huge,
like this.
Yeah, huge amounts of preparation. I think what people will like, so it won't have done Cameron any harm, is this is almost the kind of return visit. So the Obamas have been here and they've had the big kind of pomp and ceremony here. It's quite nice to be seen to being welcomed in the same way in America. I doubt there are that many people in America who actually know who Cameron is. So that's quite interesting.
Sky did a clip where they showed people on the streets of Washington pictures of David Cameron. Now, okay, you can always skew this, we all know that. Only one of them actually recognised him. I think most people still think that Tony Blair is Prime
Absolutely.
Minister here.
Probably be like that in Oxford.
In fact, many people in the Conservative Party think Tony Blair is still Prime Minister.
What about proprieties? Because the Prime Minister hasn't met any Republicans. That's strange, isn't it?
I don't know whether it's particularly strange. I mean, the Republican candidates are particularly strange.
And maybe
that's the reason that he hasn't met them. You would expect him to have met one or two Republicans. Maybe he's met some of the party people. But it's quite clear that if David Cameron had a vote in the US presidential election, he would cast it for Barack Obama. Many conservative supporters would do that. That would have been unthinkable 10, 15 years ago. And it's because the Republican Party has become a quasi-religious sect now. It's no longer a political party, and conservatives in this country don't want to support a quasi-religious sect.
Dave Hill, we're religiously tied to this relationship with America. Politicians seem obsessed with it. Why do you think that is? Is it the West Wing? Is there a sort of glamour to it, do you think?
I think it's the glamour thing, the excitement of having someone really big and bigger and more powerful than you are as your best mate. I mean, listening to the others speaking, my mind went back to that extraordinary bit of footage of Tony Blair and George Bush as they strode to the lectern together with Bush in his Air Force jacket or whatever it was, and Tony Blair scuttling along behind with his hands in the pockets of his slightly too tight jeans, looking ever so excited. And that's the sort of embarrassment that Ian is referring to. I think I still feel it.
But Dave,
if us
got invited to Camp David with the American president, we'd probably be quite excited too, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I don't blame them for being excited, but I'd still be ashamed of it. And I certainly wouldn't wear such tight jeans as Tony Blair wore that day.
Certainly the point at which one of them called you over with the word yo.
Yeah.
Yo, Dave Hill. It doesn't It's not good, is it? Of course, we played at the top that clip of Obama doing what sounded a bit like his Dick Van Dyke impression, trying to use some English phrases, chuffed to bits and top notch, and saying that he wanted a natter. And that's trivial and quite funny to us. But how much coaching, Siobhan, would have gone behind that?
Oh, loads. That's the thing. Everything, all of these kind of staged moments will have been so planned by kind of 10 or 20 officials behind the scene. That's what I find so funny about the whole thing. It's the same thing about who he should meet, who Cameron should meet and who he shouldn't meet. That would have been gone through so carefully. Some of it will be practical reasons about timing.
All politicians do that. I mean, you've got your PR advisors. You do it too.
Yeah, I've got a very small group of PR.
Well, every time you've got a different one with you, so they're not that small.
I have four.
Well, I've met three
four.
Of them.
Let's compare that. Yeah, that's it. You've met the whole team now.
If we'd known you were going to be like that, we'd never have asked.
I do have a whole host of volunteers out there, though, because everybody loves what I'm doing. So that's fantastic.
Well, while David Cameron was away across the Atlantic, it fell to the Deputy Prime Minister to take up the reins at question time in the Commons. The questions were predictably enough on the NHS bill that took another kicking at the Lib Dem spring conference. In the firing line this time, Nick Clegg.
They indulge the private sector with sweetheart deals, which we are making illegal in this bill. They want sweetheart deals with the private sector. We do not. They presided over inequality in the NHS, which, again, we are making a statutory obligation in this bill to deliver a more equal outcome in the NHS, which they failed to deliver in 13 years.
Yeah. Harriet Harman.
The absolute rubbish and...
So Ian, all the fun of the fair there in the Commons. From a Tory perspective, how did Nick Clegg do?
I should explain I'm no longer a member of the Tory party, but leaving that to one side.
You are crossing thinking.
I understand, I didn't see it myself, but everyone I've spoken to on Twitter, he actually got quite a good reaction. I mean, all the Labour people on Twitter said he was rubbish, but I think he was very feisty, it seems. And that's what you have to be in Prime Minister's questions. There's no point in being a shrinking violet, in trying to engage in rational debate. That's not what Prime Minister's questions is all about. It was good knockabout stuff, and he apparently did rather well. Harriet Harman is not to be underestimated or misunderestimated, as George Bush might say on these occasions. She actually does rather well in them. She learnt it when she often went up against William Hague. He was always expected to beat her, but actually very rarely did.
Of course, what happens in the Commons is the shop window, I suppose, in Westminster. But as we said, it's the budget next week. Again, using your experience as a very senior civil servant, what's happening in Whitehall at this time of the year, so close to the budget?
Oh, you know, Treasury goes in on itself, so there'll be lots of people preparing lots of documents and lots of officials around Whitehall waiting to hear what that's going to be. So it's a bit of an unusual time for civil servants because they really don't know what's going to be in the budget. That is held very close, actually, in the centre of Whitehall. Just going back, though, to the Commons and it being the window... And what a terrible, shocking window it is. I mean, I can't blame kids and young people today. When they see that, you say it's knockabout stuff, fine, but actually it should make some sense. And I think what we've got is ridiculous. It's macho. I just don't like it. I think it epitomises the worst of party politics.
Go to Australia. If you think this is bad, go and watch the Australian Parliament. It is 10 times worse.
Well, yeah,
this.
But that's not a measure. It's the very worst.
But if you if you want to get a measure against, say, other European parliaments, which are terribly dull and boring, they all stand at desks and make very worthy speeches. No one intervenes. There's no actual debate. It is really stage managed. Now, at least this is, I mean, I accept that obviously the Prime Minister or the Deputy Prime Minister is prepared a lot. They obviously are. But a lot of it is spontaneous. And you get to learn a lot about political leaders from how they react to PMQs. Kinnock never got the measure of Thatcher, and therefore people thought, well, he's not up to being Prime Minister. Miliband didn't at the beginning, although he's beginning to get a bit better now.
I think that I would absolutely agree with you. If I thought it was genuine debate going on in there, I would absolutely agree with you, and that should be the place because it's all transparent now. That would be great. It's not. It's, again, it's people that they've worked up the jokes, they've worked up the insults in advance, and that's what they stick to. You know, both of them yesterday were reading their scripts. There was nothing spontaneous about
that. We don't see, because very few people will watch the Parliament Channel day in, day out. But if you look at question time for cabinet ministers, for example, it's a lot more spontaneous. There is genuine questioning going on. I'm not saying there isn't some play acting. Of course there is. But, I mean, if you debate... You and I debate on a media show. There'll always be a little bit of hamming up, won't there?
A little bit.
At least from my point of view, anyway.
And it's all the shouting and the booing and the, you know, everything on the back seats and the speakers standing up. It's old fashioned. It's not fit for purpose.
Maybe we need a working party on how to improve it, and we'll get you both on it. But let's quickly move on. For in 6 weeks' time, Londoners go to the polls to elect their mayor for the next 4 years. In a year where the Olympic Games will see a huge influx of visitors and present all sorts of logistical and economic challenges, the pressure on the candidates will be intense. And of course, the question on every pollster's lips is this: is Boris Johnson a fixture now, or can he be beaten? Well, one man who should know is Dave Hill, our man in London. Dave, what do you think?
Oh, I wish you hadn't asked me that question. I haven't the slightest idea who's going to win. All you can really go on is the polls. We've had three polls this year, and all three of them have basically shown them to be neck and neck. People were amazed initially that Ken Livingstone had a very small lead in the first two of those three polls. They shouldn't have been that surprised, because it was clear where his from earlier polls the previous year where his strength lay, and his campaign has been tailored accordingly, transport fares being at the heart of it. The third of those three polls had Boris slightly ahead. It really could go either way. The bookmakers think Boris is still make Boris the favourite, which may tell us something. And the polls also tell us that most Londoners think Boris is the favourite, and that may tell us something too. But I really do have to stay firmly on the fence and say it's too close to call. Sorry.
Ian Bell, what's your feeling?
Well, I think Siobhan is leading.
Thank
you.
Absolutely.
No, I mean, seriously, folks.
Oh, look, he's trying to be nice to
I agree with Dave, actually. I think it is too close to call. And in a way, that's very good for the Boris campaign, because there was an element of complacency creeping into some of Boris's team, I think. These polls will have ripped that asunder. And I think it's going to be very close right up until the end. And when these three main candidates were chosen, I thought, well, how boring. The same three people that fought last time. This is going to be an incredibly tedious campaign. I no longer think that, partly because of the polls, partly because of what we've heard from both of the candidates so far. I think it's going to be a bit of a nasty campaign. I think it's good that some of the fringe candidates, Jenny Jones, Lawrence Webb from UKIP and Siobhan, are involved in it. I hope they get a fair hearing certainly on the hustings, because a lot of the hustings debates, people will expect them to be just Brian Paddock, Ken Livingstone, Boris Johnson. But the Greens and UKIP, I think, have a chance of pushing the Lib Dems into fourth place. The Lib Dems have never done well in London contests. And I think Brian Paddock has got a real fight on his hand to retain third place. But, of course, the key here is whoever votes for Siobhan, Jenny, Lawrence and Brian Paddock, it doesn't really matter who their first preference are. It's the second preferences that matter. Who are they going to go to?
Siobhan, I'm going to give you your platform in a moment. But Dave, quickly, does Boris have a record that he can successfully run on, do you think?
Wednesday's Mayor's Question Time, which is the last one of his term, he presented his own scorecard of his achievements, and I think he said that he reckoned he'd honoured about 90% of his manifesto commitments and was doing pretty well on some of the other ones.
I've never seen a candidate before say these are all the things I said I was going to do.
Well,
and I haven't done yet.
I think what he's trying to do.
There were only five of them.
He challenged Ken Livingstone to do the same. And what they're trying to do here is play the honesty card, because the whole thrust of Boris's campaign, which has been intensely negative right from the very beginning, is to say, ooh, that Ken Livingstone, he's horrible, you can't trust him. So that's what this is really about. But you see, the question really should be whether Boris has achieved 50%, 70% or 90% of his policy commitments or not, is whether they've been good for London, and whether what he's planning next, and we don't actually know what that is at this stage, is going to help to deal with the really, really big serious issues facing London at the moment. We've got a tale of two cities at the moment. We've got the Olympics coming up, which in a sense should be the crowning glory of London's many, many years of growth and success. But the other side, the side that was sort of revealed by the riots last year, is nothing like such a happy tale. We have a terrible housing crisis in London. We have masses of unemployment. And we've got lots and lots of people feeling the pinch. And those are the things that we really, really should be talking about. I think those are the things that Ken Livingstone is very, very anxious to have the media talking about.
I mean, cards on table here, Dave. Mm. You have declared your hand for Ken Livingstone, so let's make that quite clear so we know where you're coming from.
Well, I'm from The Guardian. Were you expecting anything else?
I know, but I was quite surprised that you did it, declared your hand so early on that.
Are you staying neutral?
Well, I have to stay neutral because of my night job on the radio. But nobody would be surprised where my inclinations lie, I guess. But I think all of those things you mentioned are exactly right, but you can't lay all of those at Boris's door. He's only been in power for the last 4 years. These are long-term things.
Absolutely, you're right. I mean, and I'm not blaming Boris for them, but the Mayor of London has an even set of powers, but they are considerable and they can make a difference. So, I mean, you mentioned earlier some of the other candidates, the Green Party's candidate Jenny Jones, Brian Paddick and Siobhan, of course. And I'm really looking for policy ideas. I mean, if this was a genuine race between a lot of different candidates, I would actually have the Green Party ahead on transport. And I would have the Liberal Democrats ahead, I would have the Liberal Democrats ahead on policing. So this exercise that we're doing with the Guardian Comment is Free at the moment, where we're asking readers to contribute ideas to a sort of ideal mayoral manifesto, is coming up with.
If I was Siobhan, I would be willing to get all those ideas because any candidate in this race, particularly the fringe candidates, they need one big idea that they can latch onto. It's no good having a policy platform of 200 policies. People want to know one policy that they're going to get from an individual candidate.
Well, let me try and get that from Siobhan.
So many things I want to come in on there, but just a couple of things there. Absolutely, we need to remind people that it's a two-vote system and that you should vote with your heart for the first vote, because that does allow new voices in the room. Okay. That's why it was set up. That's why we should use that.
Why would that vote go to you?
Because I provide exactly what we've been talking about there. I don't agree with this sense that you have to have lots and, you know, kind of one big policy idea, actually. I think an independent mayor should be open to ideas and innovation from wherever they come. That's why I'm standing on an independent platform. I don't believe the honesty ticket. I don't believe a word that Ken says. I don't believe a word that Boris says. I think their numbers are fantasy numbers. How can Boris, after 4 years, say there are £3.5 billion of efficiencies to drive out? I mean, what's he been doing for 4 years? Ken keeps saying he's going to pay for everything from uncommitted contingency pots. It just doesn't exist.
So you can't win on a plague on both their houses.
No, I can't. So what I'm saying is you also demean yourself by saying you don't believe anything they say. I do agree with Dave that actually there is this tale of two cities. There is so much in London that could be improved, especially for the most vulnerable groups in society. The thing that I am saying, which the other candidates aren't, is the mayor should be much more active in education. I'm very confident about this. I know people say it's not directly in the mayor's remit. Well, the mayor lobbies all the time on issues and areas that aren't in their direct remit. The single thing that can transform London more than anything else is to get our education system working better for everybody in London. We have a problem with primary school places and nobody's addressing it. We have a problem with the transition to secondary school and nobody's addressing it. We need an education commissioner for London that's going to tackle all of those things.
But can you have the thrust of your campaign, something that actually isn't within your direct remit?
Yes, you can, absolutely, because all of those other things...
But you've got no power to change it.
The mayor has no power over education. The mayor should be a leader for London. The mayor has no direct powers over lobbying on behalf of business, but nobody criticises the mayor for doing that. That's exactly what a strong leader for London should do. If you're a chief exec of a company, you would not be happy if your people, your staff, were not fulfilling their potential. When you look at London, people are not fulfilling their potential because right from day one, our education system lets people down. As a mayor, as the leader of London, you should be screaming about that.
Let me bring in Dave Hill.
You don't seem to understand what the powers of the mayor are.
Let me bring in Dave Hill. Dave, is that distinctive enough for you?
Majoring on education?
Yeah.
Well, I do agree, actually, that it is almost completely outside the brief of the mayor at the moment. I mean, there's an interesting argument about whether it should be brought within the mayor's powers. Quite a lot of people think that health should be brought within under the mayor's control in London as well. But that is a slightly academic argument in terms of what's happening now. Ian expressed surprise earlier that I declared so clearly and loudly in favour of Ken over Boris this time. I preferred Ken over Boris last time. But actually, I think the margin is going to be greater this time. And the one big reason for that is that although Boris appears to be campaigning without calling himself a conservative at the moment, he hit the trajectory of his mayoralty so far, and the likely trajectory of it next time will be to prepare the ground and facilitate the policies of the Conservative-led government, and that is very, very bad news for London.
He has been very independent of the coalition.
One thing you can depend on from Ken Livingstone is that he will fight Tories tooth and nail, and that's what I want from the next one.
I think what you want from a mayor is somebody who maybe is of a party, I mean, most politicians are, but can actually be independent of that party. And people do believe that Boris is equally independent of the Conservative Party, as Ken obviously is from the Labour Party.
What do you think the issue is, or the issues that are going to decide this election now? We don't know yet who's going to win it, but what do you think?
Well, I think if Ken does win, and I think it's entirely possible that he could, I think it will be for the very same reason that he lost last time, because Gordon Brown played a big part in losing Ken the last election. Ken has never actually blamed Gordon Brown, to his credit, but I think most electoral students would think that. And I think depending on how the coalition is seen, that is going to have a major impact on people's voting intentions. I think there'll be a lot of people, and this is where the independents or the smaller party candidates could clean up in a sense. A lot of people are going to be angry with the coalition for all the reasons that we all know. Now, do those votes go to Ken or do they go to some of the other candidates? I don't know at the moment. And I think if these attacks on Ken, on taxation, I mean, that's lasted a lot longer than I thought it would. If they stick, I mean, I've had quite a few people ring into my LBC show, and I don't necessarily take that as a litmus test, but quite a few people say, well, I have supported Ken, but I think this is outrageous, what he's doing. I've actually defended him because I do exactly the same kind of tax arrangement myself, so I'm not going to criticise him for that, but he has been slightly hypocritical.
It's whether a Labour man
could I just
that,
say that the point Ian makes about the closeness or otherwise of a candidate's affiliation with their party is very relevant in this one. And what's so interesting is that it's different with Ken Livingstone this time round. In the past, he has definitely prospered from appearing to be semi-detached from the Labour Party, his own man and so on. But this time, he's tying himself much more closely to the Labour Party, and with good reason, because if you look at the polls, particularly the YouGov ones, they show that Ken has consistently shown that Ken has been trailing the Labour vote in London. In the past, it was the other way around. He's got to get the key to victory. The biggest single key to victory is for Ken to get the Labour vote in London swinging completely behind him. If he does that, he will win.
Very quickly, Siobhan, now I've got to move on.
I mean, this discussion to me is really, you know, it's fundamental to my platform. I don't want people to think assume that you have to have a mayor who's either related to Labour or related to Conservative. The whole point is you need somebody who rises above that and will fight for what's right for London. Now, some things might be that you bring in something that's traditionally seen to be a Tory policy. In other areas, what's better for London might be something that the Labour Party would be putting forward. We need to break out of this. We're in this assumption that it has to be party political. That's not the best thing for London. If David's calling for somebody, which he keeps doing, saying what's best for London, what's best for London, then break out of the things that we've had before, because sticking to party politics, which is what they do, even if they play the Mavericks, ultimately they stick to party politics. It's not the best thing for London.
I can promise you that I'm not running, by the way, just for the record.
Well, maybe you should. Well, there's an idea.
I am looking forward to the manifesto, though. I'm looking forward to all the ideas.
So am I, if it ever gets written.
Well, we have 6 weeks to see how this one's going to play itself out, but we just now have time for one item. Read any good books lately? If so, were they memoirs and were they political memoirs? There are a lot of politicians writing them, but who's reading them? The Daily Telegraph this week said that the autobiography of Peter Hayne has sold just 500 copies.
Which I published.
Ian, you published it, indeed. That's right.
And the Daily Telegraph has apologised for that because it's actually sold out and we're considering a second print run.
What does that mean?
Well, that means it sold between 3,000 and 4,000 copies. Now, that doesn't sound an awful lot, but I mean, the book trade has changed a lot. People's book habits have changed a lot. A lot of people read books on Kindles and whatever now. So political memoirs have never been bestsellers unless you are sort of Tony Blair, Margaret Thatcher, someone like that. If you are a sort of middle-ranking cabinet minister, you know that you're not going to sort of break sales records. And the Peter Hayne book, I actually think I published about 220 books in the last 3 years, and I would say that's in the top 10 because it's half the book is about his time in Africa fighting apartheid, so it's not all just Labour Party politics. And he even manages to make Wales and Northern Ireland sound interesting.
What does make a good memoir? I mean, what's that argument between the diary style that Chris Mullin might have and the narrative style of others?
Well, there's a saying that a political autobiography is a work of fiction about yourself, and there is a degree of truth in that. And if you just use it to justify decisions that you made, it's going to be rather boring. You've got to be honest about skeletons in your closet. You've got to talk about any scandal that you've been through. You've got to give your honest opinion about your colleagues. Anne Widdecombe always said that she would never write her memoirs because she didn't want a friendless old age. Now, funnily enough, her memoirs are being published this year, so she's obviously
she
had a bit
mind
of
a friendless old she's age.
She lives in the middle of Dartmoor on her own, so that may say
halfway there.
But I mean, if she says what I think she ought to say, it will be a very interesting book. I mean, I love political memoirs. It's sort of more, I read political memoirs and I read footballers' memoirs. I don't know what that says about me. It probably says I'm very sad.
An agent once told me that political books only sell if the politician themselves are popular. So if you have someone like Mo Molum, who's kind of has this general, almost celebrity popularity or had, then that will sell. But most politicians, or particularly politicians who might be respected but aren't actually popular, aren't actually liked, those books won't sell.
There is a degree of truth in that, but it depends what you mean by selling. I regard anything above 4,000 copies as a great success as a political memoir. Now, I published John Knott's memoirs a few years ago. That, together with a hardback and paperback, I think that did about 12,000 copies. Now, for a politician that went from the cabinet 30 years ago, that's not bad. So, yes, of course, if you have a certain celebrity to your name, you are Peter Mandelson, for example. His book did incredibly well. But if you're sort of Jack Straw, who's touting his memoirs at the moment.
Unsuccessfully.
Well, I was told that by an agent that they'd got a six-figure advance for Jack Straw because I'd actually expressed interest in publishing it. And I thought, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, who on earth is going to pay a six-figure sum? But some mad publisher apparently did, although I read this week that they're back on the market.
Siobhan, what do you look for when you pick up a political memoir?
I don't read them that often, I've got to admit. I think that's probably
because... you see enough of them in
the
daytime?
Yeah, exactly. I see enough of them in the daytime. And also, I think by the time you get the book, you've kind of seen it all in papers. You know, they've released bits of it or whatever in the papers. Having said that, I'm just thinking, you know, 15 years I was right at the top of government. I've seen quite a lot of stuff there that hasn't come out. And
well, maybe
and
after May the 3rd, you should come and see me, Siobhan, and maybe we'll publish your memoir.
Yeah, writing, and I'll take 10% because the deal will happen.
Doing the deal here.
Dave Hill, Ken wrote a book not so long ago. Was it interesting?
I haven't read it.
Well, I have, because I was offered it to publish.
And
I have told Ken this, so I'm not breaking any secrets. I thought it was rather dull. Mm. And I did put an offer in on it, but it wasn't anywhere near what... I mean, I think he's declared what he got paid. He got paid an 80,000 advance for it.
I mean, you do want a good read,
Faber.
Don't you?
But it's like
boring.
700 pages. Mm. Sorry, who wants to read 700 pages about Ken Livingstone? I mean, I have, but I'm a political...
And he is such a public figure, and in his interviews,
but that's
he talks
why somebody,
about everything. So what's left for the book?
Somebody like Peter Mandelson, I think that's probably why people want to buy it, because they think he's going to give you a bit of gossip, just because that's kind of the nature.
And he did.
Exactly.
I hardly read any of them, but I have read Sonia Pennell's Boris biography. Boris has been lucky, really. There's been two very good biographies of him. The other one was by Andrew Jimson, and both of them have sort of revealed the true Boris behind the jovial persona in rather skillful ways. But I'm just looking at my bookcase now, and the best one I've ever read, the best political biography I've ever read, is One of Us by Hugo Young about Margaret Thatcher.
You're absolutely
and you'll be
right.
I was totally and utterly
whenever,
absorbed by that.
I mean, I've written a few books on Margaret Thatcher, and I often get asked, which is the best biography? And that's exactly the one I quote too. It is an absolute masterpiece. From someone who wasn't, shall we say, a fan of Margaret Thatcher, it's a very, very fair book.
That's absolutely right, yeah, because he just captures with the right amount of dispassion exactly the important things about what she did and why she did them.
And do you, Ian, look across the landscape now and think, I'd really like that book, that person's really interesting?
Well, I do, and the thing to do for any publisher is to look at who's on the way up and think, well, is it worth having a book done about them? And we've commissioned, and you may laugh at this, but we've commissioned a biography of George Osborne by Janan Ganesh, who's from The Economist, a really up-and-coming young journalist. He's now on the Sunday Politics every week. That's coming out in October, and a lot of people say, oh, who would want to read a book about George Osborne? This guy could well be Prime Minister one day. He's the most powerful man in the government. A cabinet minister said to me yesterday, I can easily get to see David Cameron about anything. it's much more difficult to see the Chancellor. That's political power.
And of course he has a past. He has an interesting hinterland.
Well, I'm not sure what you're referring to there. Well, in fact, I do know what you're referring to there. We will see in the book, won't we?
We will indeed.
Or not.
I'm sure it will be a good read. But that's all we do have time for on this edition of Politics Weekly. My thanks to Dave Hill, to Siobhan Benita and Ian Dale. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Thanks for listening.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.